Thank you, Steve. It's great to be here. As some of you know, I've been to Singapore a number of times, and it's just not only the best food in the world, but also the nicest people in the world. So thank you for inviting me back here. Now, we have a big agenda for this morning, so without much ado, I just do want to get started here. And here's the agenda. I have 1 hour to talk about data. Then we do a tea break. Then we have 45 minutes to do breakout sessions, which are structured as four times 10 minutes, where I give you little exercises and I collect right away. Then we have time, we have the video for the brief idea video.
Yeah, that's a short thing.
Short video.
I'll just say something about this techno-strategist work.
Okay. And then we have another hour for the second part, for the second major part, where I just want to discuss cases with you of companies which I've worked with here in this spirit of the consumer data revolution, realizing the true power of your customers and the data they create. Okay. Can we turn the volume down a little bit because it's a little bit too much echo for me here, and I think I can talk loud enough so you can hear me well. If you have any questions, do interrupt me. I know the stuff. Sometimes I'm not thinking about explaining things all that well because I assume that you know it already, and I do want you to get as much out of this workshop, out of this master class where we work together as you possibly can. All right? Okay, so the consumer data revolution. What is that? If we think what data were created in the decade where some of us were born, there was very little. Well, I had a handwritten passport, and even my driver's license in the late 70s was still typed, and there was some list where this typed information was. Very, very, very little data existed about individuals. So I would argue that in this couple of hours since you got up this morning, you've created more data than the first 10 years or 20 even years of the people of my age. So that's a data revolution, and most of this data were created passively. For instance, knowing which cell stations you walk through here coming to SMU, the mobile phone operator, of course, knows how to reach you there. And sometimes companies try to sort of what I call sniff the digital exhaust, to go behind people and see what are the traces which they are leaving. That is often what people consider data mining. That's what I teach at Stanford. And data mining, as I always say, in the last decade, in the 90s, was given a data source, what insights can you get? Many of you have experiences in your companies of having done data mining, and I know usually it doesn't go as well as you thought initially of setting up. There are cultural reasons, often that the people who built the data warehouse might not be the ones who also have fun analyzing their data, and the energy just simply has disappeared once you have done all this loading of the data. So we'll talk a little bit about cultural things at the end of the talk today. But the more important reason is that it's a damn hard problem, that question, given a set of data, what insights can I get? Now, the world has changed. In the last 2 years, the problem has been redefined to, given a problem, what data can I get? You see, the old problem was, given a set of data, there's these data tombs which have been created. Gee, what insights can I get? Most people don't get to it. Now the question is, given a problem, what data can I go out and get? And at the deep underlying heart of this is that the cost of communication has dropped by orders of magnitude over the last 10, 20 years. So we now have bidirectional communication. It's not only sniffing the digital exhaust, but it's also creating incentives for people to actually give us data, and they only give us data if they see a benefit down the road, maybe in the next 30 seconds. Benefit could be that something, you know, gets recommended to them, they discover something you wouldn't know otherwise. It could be that they meet somebody in the evening who they wouldn't meet otherwise. It could be that their life gets simpler. You know, there are many reasons for benefits. I'm not just talking about financial benefits. So that is what's new. this bi-directional communication made very simple and very easily. Now, when I looked at the list of the attendees, I realized that a number of companies, probably of yours, have some consumers, have some people, have some clients, some people you sell to. Now, the interesting thing is in this consumer data revolution that while it's super easy to reach your friends, it is not always so super easy to reach the companies. So what I'm going to explore here in the first hour when I talk about data is what actually is happening here in the creation of data and what is the shift in mindset, both towards other individuals and, for us more importantly here at SMU, the shift in expectations to companies. Okay, so the first one is sniffing the digital exhaust, building these data tombs. What's new here is that there are new data sources appearing, particularly location data. On my homepage on viking.com, I publish every few minutes my location. So I have a little GPS device which talks to satellites, so even works when I'm in Antarctica this winter, their summer, and so you know exactly where I was. I was at Burning Man last month, 2 months ago, and you knew exactly which time of the day I'm moving where.
Now, why do I care?
You might not, but some people might be interested. And I'm interested because it's actually a very good question. It's actually my way of knowing where and when. So when at the end of the month I write my bills, I just click at a certain address, and it tells me exactly when I was at that address. Plus, it's an interesting way of meeting people. You know, you're in the airport lounge, people might be more likely to actually say, hey, Andreas, I see you're here. So why do I care is one thing. Why do I worry is another thing. And most people say, isn't that dangerous? And my answer is, dude, why? Well, maybe somebody wants to break into your house. Well, if somebody wants to break in my house, he better break my house when I'm not there. So if you really think about this, and lots of the examples I give you, about 10 examples, all push on that button, what the risks are and what the benefits are. What the benefits are for the individual, because the consumer data revolution is about that the expectations are shifting, the attitude of individuals to the information is such that they want to see a benefit. So the two data sources which are new is that it's not just sniffing the digital exhaust, but it's individuals talking about themselves. Who of you has an account at Facebook? Okay, about half of the people. Who of you actually uses it on a daily basis? Okay, that's the young generation, right? Cool. So you talk about yourselves, what you're doing right now, you take pictures of your friends, but more importantly than that is that you reveal not only things about you as a node, but you reveal things about the connections you have to other people. So the way I look at it is, if you take my passport, you know, Steve and I, if we go to Singapore immigration, they probably can't tell the difference between us. So hey, he has no problem getting in to Singapore with my passport. However, if Steve was to take my username and password at Facebook, within, I think, a couple of quick IMs to people, people would say, what have you been smoking, dude? So the relationships we have with people are much more stable than what we say about ourselves. At the very end of the talk today, I'm going to talk about viral marketing. I'm talking about social marketing. And I've actually worked, as a case, with a German company called Otto Group. It's the second largest distant retailer in the world. They have many brands, 20 billion revenues last year. And it is so much more powerful if you actually market to people who know each other than if you try to do demographics, psychographics, and so on and so forth. So the third point here in this consumer data revolution, namely that I reveal stuff not about myself, only what I'm interested in, but I reveal my social connections. That really is the change which we are witnessing. So again, what is happening? We had implicit data, which companies collect. And many of you, I think, came today. Let me actually ask you, How many of you came today with the thinking that that's primarily what I'm talking about? How you can make sense of the data which you're collecting anyways? Okay. But as I said, that's the question which is the hard question. The easier question is, how can you create incentives so people talk and help you sell your stuff? And how can you create incentives so people actually help you sell your stuff, not only to them, but also to your friends? In academic terms, actually, this is called customer lifetime value, which comes with two components. One component is, how much money can your company make off me? And that's what most of you probably consider. I remember, for instance, getting a call from Singapore Airlines once asking me, you know, what should be the coefficient for customer lifetime value? And I said, reframe the problem. Why do you need it? Well, somebody asked me. So I think we should do totally different things. And over lunch break, I go over to Singapore Airlines today. Versus, how actually can I influence my friends to also fly SQ or to buy items? And that can be a much larger amount of money than what they get out of me myself.
Andreas, you should have just given the guy a number like 0.3 and hung up the phone.
So what are examples of these sources of data? And by the way, I hope you don't mind, but to be forward compatible, some of my slides already have Chinese on them, you know. So they're, of course, order data. So for instance, Amazon.com produces a few gigabytes per year. Then there are click data. So clicks are much more upstream in the process of gathering information. Sometimes I call it the process of creating and maintaining product space awareness. So for instance, the Facebook weblogs are a few terabytes a day. By the way, how much does a terabyte cost? Anybody an idea? What do you think? A terabyte of data. More than you'll ever produce in your life. It's about $100. So in terms of storage space costs, all these things are negligible. So sometimes I say storage is free. It's really the communication cost and the cost of the recipient which matters, not the storage cost. Then we have intention data. So if you think about Google, Google is a good position because Google knows way ahead of time what you're interested. So if I say Singapore pizzeria, if there's such a thing here, then Google knows that down the road they might show me some ads for pizzerias in Singapore. Then we have attention data. And part of what we try to do is turning attention into intention. And I will show you an example here of a company called Delicious, where you just tag websites. And I'll show you how that can be used to discover things and to help you discover things other people have discovered for you. Then there are interaction data, and I'll show you a very new company called Skydeck, which analyzes my phone logs and tells me who I should be calling and how the relationships are going. And then finally, okay, location data, GPS. This year alone, Nokia is selling 100 million phones which have GPS data. I will use the GPS example in Nokia when I talk the economics of data and when I talk the acquisition of Navteq by Nokia about a year ago. I have two or three slides because I realized when I was in Finland actually last week that while I live and swim in the Web 2.0 world, not everybody does. So when I looked at your companies, I thought maybe it's worth just to give a couple of points crisply about how I see Web 2.0. Actually, the most important thing is Web 2.0 is people 2.0. So Web 2.0 is not, you know, new technology or stuff like this, but it is new ways of thinking about collaboration. So whereas Web 1.0 is about pages, Web 2.0 is about people. So we could say Web 1.0 is about commerce. Web 2.0 isn't about commerce. It's about interactions, about individuals. So Web 1.0 is about gathering data. You remember the digital exhaust. Whereas Web 2.0 is about participation, about contribution. So sometimes, to be cute, we can say Web 1.0 is about impressions, whereas Web 2.0 is about the impressed, the people. So the afternoon talk is actually how we moved from e-business to me business, so I'll talk about this topic in more detail in the afternoon. Few properties are that Web 1.0 is read-only, Web 2.0 is read and write. I was at a company called Best Buy, 40 billion revenues a couple of months ago, and did a very high-level workshop with management. And I was absolutely amazed when Peter Hirschberg, former CMO of Apple, who I did this workshop with, interviewed the CEO of Best Buy at the beginning of September at Google. And I'll show you the link, actually, to the video. And the guy says, Best Buy is one wiki. That's pretty amazing. A company, 40 billion revenues, I said, 140,000 people, everybody can read and write to the database. So if you're an employee who really loves, you know, Wii games, you can write a chapter about Wii games, and other people can look at it. If you're a consumer in the store, you can be reached on your mobile, and you can reach the company mobile, and you can attach interesting information to the items which they have. Think about that difference. To pay a couple of guys who sit there and enter product information versus having, for the first stage, 100,000 people enter product information about the stuff they are interested in, and the second stage having maybe 10 million people, potentially 100 million people, enter information, debugging the database. Do you see that difference between Web 1.0 and Web 2.0, that suddenly you have actually the world helping you create better data? So the consumer is actually not just the consumer, but sometimes we say he's a prosumer because he's a producer of data as well as a consumer of data. Many of you come with the question, how can we create stickiness? And probably have something in mind that we make it really difficult for you to leave the company. Carriers, phone companies, are beautiful examples for that. Because there you sign up and then for 24 months they have you. They call this a relationship business. I can only laugh, it's hostage. Whereas in Web 2.0, it's just having as low barrier as possible of getting in, a low barrier of adoption. So there's one difference, that in Web 1.0, it was about testing, pre-testing it again, and validating before you roll it out. In Web 2.0, we call it launch and learn, fast feedback cycles, or as Facebook calls it, push and pray. Different philosophies, different company cultures. Here, you have a culture of constant online measurement, of establishing metrics and seeing every day the 7 versions you release, what's the effect on the metrics, and then constantly learning, very fast cycle. Whereas here it is, well, the release cycle of our next website, if you think about Singapore Airlines, must lie in the years. Discovery, I'm very interested in discovery. Discovery on the Web 1.0 world is based on hyperlinks. It's based in a world of control where people carefully craft, am I linking there or am I not linking there? An example for that is Amazon.com, where 4 or 5 years ago, Amazon was trying out to use Google advertisements on Amazon's site. It's called AdSense. And we weren't sure what would be the long-term effect. Because the short-term effect was every day a check of $500,000 arrived. Good enough for lunch. But what's the long-term effect? If you show people at Amazon that there are other websites where they potentially, for less money, can buy the same stuff. And books, CDs, music, videos are, of course, totally interchangeable. It doesn't really matter where you bought that CD. The bits are the same. And it turned out that the long-term effect actually was a positive one. Because people saw that Amazon helps them in the decision-making process. And that philosophy, that you are on the side of the consumer, that you don't use the data against them, but that you use the data in order to help them make better decisions, that truly is one of the underlying drivers, which I believe makes Amazon a great company. And just as I looked yesterday for a book called The Support Economy, which I, by the way, recommend to you, by Shoshana Zuboff, a Harvard professor. It said, hey, you already bought that book 2 years ago. So as opposed to other companies which say, hey, I can sell him another copy, or probably not even knowing that I already bought a copy. Amazon helps me in this decision process, as opposed to trying to control it. Discovery, in this case of Web 2.0, is based on social relationships, and trust, reputation, is often built on transparency. For instance, an example, an early example of Web 2.0, of course, is Amazon reviews, where people write reviews about books. And I can't tell you how often in my time as chief scientist at Amazon, I was asked about whether those reviews are fake. And my answer is, of course some of the reviews are fake. With millions and millions of reviews, I mean, you can't pay somebody to check the reviews, make a phone call anyhow. Did you really write it? Of course not. But by creating transparency, meaning if you click on the author of that review, and now you see all the other reviews he or she has written, you can be pretty good in getting a feeling whether you trust the person or whether you don't trust the person. An interesting discussion which we'll have in the panel today is about identity. And that actually traces back to lots of discussions I had with Jeff Bezos about this, where Jeff finally decided to have a true identity as an option for people, where they grab the name as in the credit card, and you can vote for having your first name abbreviated to the first initial if you don't want to have your gender revealed. And that is another way of increasing trust. So not just having pseudonyms, which are not bad. I mean, I'm A. Weigand, which is pretty consistent, and people could look at my history, but actually saying, we don't know who the person is, but we know he used a credit card which says Andreas Weigand. Last point here, Web 1.0 is about push. It's about targeting based on that digital exhaust. Whereas Web 2.0 is about pull. It's offering, it's about discovering. It's demand-driven as opposed to Web 1.0 being supply-driven.
So could you expand a little bit on that demand-driven versus supply-driven? How does that differ?
Yes, thank you for asking. In Web 2.0, because you empower people to actually tell you what they want, that's what I call more of a demand. So for example, you could say on Craigslist, which is again something which I'm not sure whether it's here in Singapore, but where people basically in a very simple interface can have text ads, little ads, what do you want? And then you have some algorithm which help you find those electronically. So it's the demand that people express the demand, as opposed to that companies have supply or an oversupply of certain items, and then try to figure out how to spin it and get it across. There's not much spinning past in Web 2.0, because transparency really, you know, kills empty spinning events. Good question. The costs have come down absolutely dramatically. So if we talk about financial costs as opposed to potentially reputation risk that something funny is there, we talk about financial costs right now, what it costs to build. As those of you who are in the business of actually building systems know, it's become extremely cheap to build stuff. That's actually a big problem for VCs, because many companies don't need the millions and millions of dollars they needed a few years ago to build scalable systems. One element there is certainly that cloud computing, that you just build one thing and then you get as many cycles from Amazon or from Google as you need, has made a big difference, that you don't have to buy racks and racks of hardware. Same for storage, which you already agreed is free. Benefits we will see are actually in a multitude of ways. I'm sort of a product guy. I love product. So the feedback you get in product is not bad if you just look at what people are clicking at, but the feedback you get by empowering people to actually comment on the product is much more powerful. So how do you measure a better product versus a not as good product hard? How do you measure that actually? And I don't want to sound pathetic here, but the world is a better place if we have better products. For instance, the elevator here, it's a hard way how these buttons are arranged. Maybe Singaporeans are used to it. I got out of the elevator because I thought it didn't have a sixth floor. Honestly, I mean, I'm not sure I was in the elevator with some of you here, and you probably thought the guy doesn't, you know how to read. But if there was a way of just simply annotating that, of tagging that, of giving feedback, that would be making a difference. No, no, I'll have some examples, actually. Why don't I just skip to one simple example here, which we did at Amazon, is that at every single page, there at the bottom of the page is this signature, this feedback box, suggestion box, where you can enter whatever it is that you're entering. For instance, here, the page may take too long to load, and then that goes to one person, actually. We don't try to automate this process. It's about 1,000 such things which come in a day. And then they decide what makes sense, and the expectations are very clear. You don't hear from Amazon. Thank you for helping us out. I know that the totally lightweight, the cost for you is essentially zero to do this, but you have 1 million eyeballs a day checking out your site. And it's about 1,000 things, so every 0.1% of them actually see something.
But the cost of doing this can't be zero, because then you need automated capability on the back end.
No, one person. One not well-paid person gets through about 1,000 things a day, and what he doesn't get through, he drops on the floor. Who cares, right? Very different from OCBC, where you don't want to drop that transaction on the floor which you didn't get to. So here, you know, one guy, 100,000 thing a year, including overhead, and basically, you know, building this thing is a day's work. So I have to say that the spectrum of companies I work with is really huge. The company I worked with in Finland last week was just a total joy. So putting Finland between Shanghai and Singapore, which originally was planned to be sort of one trip, is not, you know, something which has a low cost of flying. But it was just great. Or some of the Singaporean companies I worked with, like Stu's company, are just an absolute joy to work with because people get it, people enjoy doing it, and people know that there's something there and do it right. But I have to say, for instance, sticking to the Best Buy example before, that was an uphill battle. That was an uphill battle. And that's why when at the end effect, as I said, the CEO says, we are one wiki, you say, wow, you know, it was worth the trouble. The underlying thing which I don't have time to talk about today, just 2 cents about it, is that you first start and really get the right metrics in place. And the metrics have shifted from metrics for the company to consumer-centric metrics. So it could be, and one company I just invite you to look at is called Yelp, YELP.com, and it's just super beautiful. All the different metrics they have that incentivize people to do more. Hey, you are the first reviewer in 17 restaurants. Great. Nobody can take this away from you anymore. And so many percent of people think that you are a cool guy or a funny guy or whatever it is. So not the number of page views in a day, but trying to give people something back. So having metrics in place is the starting point to actually do any of these things, and that's how you measure it. So the financial thing comes down the road, difficult to know for product, but the engagement, the user engagement, I did a panel on metrics of engagement about 2 months ago in California, is actually where a lot of interesting stuff is happening. Happy to talk about this maybe over lunch, but I want to get, before we run out of time here, two more examples of data. So here's one. Cost is, you know, one person plus a couple of days of development. And it's very interesting how something as trivial as this, the page load time, can make a 4% effect on the bottom line. Amazon moved image servers, a copy of image servers to Japan for Amazon.co.jp, 4% sales increase. You know, you wouldn't guess this, but by measuring it, you say that definitely was worth, you know, duplicating our images. Here's another example where, yes, please. And if you say, by the way, which company you're at, because I don't know whether everybody knows everybody.
From SPH.
Say again?
Simple Press
Holding. SPH, okay.
Web 2, you're talking about experience, customer experience, right? Okay. Every time when you finish a transaction, for example, in web, you go to a long series of procedure, and at the end, you ask for feedback. Okay, I have my experience when I finished my Facebook in the first instance, first generation. Easy. Adaptation, very easy. After they revamp it, more things comes in. Maybe look a bit difficult to do. Same thing. I finished purchasing, you ask me for feedback. Okay? The barrier of adaptation will change. And I will go up, because now in this second generation, you're asking the producer to create and the consumer to create data for you. How would you, maybe in an example, try to technology-wise, money and sense-wise, I don't bother. Okay, I'm concerned, how do I get my technology, my data online quicker?
Good. The answer is you take whatever you can get. So if you make it really easy for people to give you stuff when they feel like giving you stuff, not when you feel like you want the stuff, but when they feel like giving you stuff, then that's the way, sort of the generic answer, to get to rich data. So this notion of as soon as you ended your transaction, boom, a 7-page survey hits you, is not happening. Or even worse, 3 weeks after you stayed at that hotel in Korea, there comes a generic message of, please fill in when you were there and, you know, which room you're in. Gee, you know, don't you know this? Or, you know, an airline say, asking me which flight number were you in. Okay, I'm happy to do this. What's your frequent flyer number? Gee, if I give you my frequent flyer number, you actually know already which flight number was there. Which class of service were you in? I mean, can't you get this? What was, you know, your point of origin? I mean, then they lose my trust. And I totally understand that's a different company doing the survey, which doesn't have access to the frequent flyer data. But that's how you don't get true consumer data. Because a person feels, you know, if I'm telling them which class of service I flew on which day, you know, they don't really care for me. But if they say, enter your frequent flyer number, and enter the day, or the flight number, or something like this, and now let's talk. Let's talk interactively. That would be very different. So you have to really think away from this printed thing, check the box, to let's play. Give us whenever you feel like it. And that's why I gave you the previous example here of any page you want to tell us something is there for you. Quick example is Amazon had trucks driving to 32 cities in the United States. And again, no person can be paid to label pictures of every single house. So just put it up, roughly with GPS, and then ask the user to say which of these images is, and there we are. Google Maps, same thing. Google Maps, you can move the location of any spot by 200 meters, up to 200 meters. So if my GPS doesn't quite get the address right, but thinks actually I mistaken my neighbor's place, then I can say actually that location is 2150 17th Street, not 2148 17th Street. And if it's more than 200 meters, then thinking, yeah, I might be fishy, and they have other processes in place. But so, they have essentially 1 billion people, clean maps for them. Interesting, huh? And not by saying, please fill out the survey, is your house right? But while you are there, click here if you want to move the icon. By the way, Amazon, of course, monetizes this by having better data than others, by saying, click to call business, and there it works, voice over IP. They use ATG for that, which then a few cents in their pocket as you make a call there. Okay, we talked about intention and attention. So just a couple of quick slides about how we can move deeper into the thought process and understand our customers better. A click, well, we can only click on stuff that's on the page. Search, as you said, Google is about the intention economy, allows us to express intention, but we do not know whether actually what we showed in response to the search results was something which the consumer cared for. An important distinction for those of you every now and then might need to think about click data is the distinction between long clicks and short clicks. What does that mean? A long click means that somebody goes, say, to Google, clicks, and then stays somewhere else for a minute or 2 minutes and then comes back. Good thing. A short click is he clicks on something, goes somewhere else, comes back after 2 seconds. So we clearly didn't show him behind those couple of abstracted sentences or lines under the URL. We didn't show him what he was looking for. So you constantly learn about how do you improve your search results. I actually think that, just jumping ahead for a second, the purpose of most of this data is to help us find relevance functions in life. So there's more out there than you can deal with, whether it is restaurants in Singapore or you name it, whatever you're looking for, there's way more out there that you can deal with. So all these data sources, I think, can be viewed from the perspective as how useful are they for showing us as quickly as possible what is of genuine interest to us. So that's, I think, one framework I want to put in your mind, how you can evaluate how actually relevant data sources are. And that's also, I think, why I just gave you the example between short clicks and long clicks. Okay, search is here, and then tags. Tags means that you attach a certain label, and the purpose, and that is Joshua Schachter, who I worked with at Delicious in the early days, who says the purpose are one, to remember, two, to share, and three, to discover. Note that the self-interest of remembering something is the first position. It's not community, I do something good for the world, but hey, I want to remember that URL, I want to remember that person, I want to remember it, so hey, I want to remember it across computers. Let's use Delicious for that. Delicious was bought by Yahoo for 20-30 million. And I want to then share it and allow others to discover it. So sometimes people say that tags are actually distilled attention. Or sometimes people say, you are what you tag. Or sometimes people say, you are what you are tagged as, or who you are tagged by. The example here is a person called Lawrence Lee. Tags see housing maps, so I can look at the certain tag and discover a topic. What all the world? How is the world organized? By people, Web 2.0. Not by the people putting the hyperlinks, but those people who actually find content similar by giving the word maps to this. Then I can discover, hey, what's Lawrence Lee interested in? And thirdly, I can say, what are other people interested in who actually look at this page? That's very powerful. No individual website can give you the discovery of a topic, the discovery of other people's interests, and of other people where else they're going. So it really is a basis of putting a web across the current web, which is a web of connections based on where people go, based on what people find similar.
Can you explain that, Andreas? So
yes.
This is a page off of Delicious, right?
Yes.
And the housing maps, Craigslist, housing Google, who put that in? Is that
great?
Is that on Delicious or a user put that in?
That is actually on Delicious. That is like if you go here to the, in my case, Viking.com, that's the page title, the HTML tag, put in by the user. Let's go to Delicious. And who of you thinks they have an interesting website? SPH? You have this nano. I had a student in my course at Tsinghua.
Asia1.com.
Is that clean? You know, I don't want to. Yeah? Okay. So then what I do is here, I will look up a URL just so you see what I did here, I clicked on this. I mean, this, I don't need to be registered. I happen to be signed in right now, but that's not important. And it's called
AsiaOne.com.
Okay. So now, by hitting return, it shows us all those 44 people who actually have looked at that site. Now, it also gives pat on the shoulder of the person who first bookmarked it in February 2005, namely Curious55. And now it, you know, here shows the tags. It seems to be our news. It seems about Singapore. That's a very common tag there. And now I can look at what other people, actually, these people are there, what other things they've looked at. So I just randomly click on one guy, and now he also is interested in the New Hanoian and BBC Sports. So he seems to be interested in sports and so on. So now you see the traces people leave, but not the digital exhaust they leave, but the explicitly contributed data, and can follow them.
So I'm not a Delicious user. So how does Delicious know this guy went to those places? Because he tagged them through Delicious?
Yes, because this guy explicitly says, his distilled formative attention, he says, I want to remember those things. So it is not just seeing where did he go. That's what Google does, but Google doesn't give it to us. Google knows this if you have the Google toolbar installed. But it is here that the guy says, hey, this is what I'm interested in. And now we know what he does. And we can also see how other people think that's relevant and what tags he gave. It's just one example of tagging. It was not putting in a plug for Delicious here. It was putting in an example of how people contribute to the web. This thing, again, is not complicated to build. Actually, Joshua had this thing running pretty much like this in his bedroom in New York. So he did it when he was a grad student at CMU. He then was a trader at Morgan Stanley, and he felt just the need that he wanted to remember his bookmarks to share it with their friends. So it is one example there. Of course, in each case, 100 clones, 80 of them in China, Aigui being one of them. So just I'm not trying to push Delicious here, just to be very clear. I showed you an example. People do things for themselves, which then create value for the community. Absolutely, totally, yes. So who cares? So if you do Delicious, you're probably similarly nerdy as the other people using Delicious. So great, you have a community like this. The web is about selecting in. The web is not about being representative. And I did a workshop for the World Economic Forum in Davos, and it was very interesting that that notion of being open and allowing people to select in is not necessarily the notion all, you know, leaders of the world have. Some groups define themselves by not letting others in. Other groups define themselves by selecting in. And the web, and that's actually quoting Joshua here, is really defined by selecting into groups.
If I'm the AsiaOne guy, I do care about representative opinions.
I'm not sure. I care for opinions. And I actually don't know, does SPH run AsiaOne or
no? It's our portal.
Okay, it's a portal. So I care for whatever I can get, properly ranked by my relevance function. So I rather have, you know, interesting things here than trying to get something representative. So that notion of being representative is very important for, you know, if you want to predict elections. But if you want to improve your site, then if you want to know who are typical people who actually care for my site enough that they want to remember it, it's good. It's one of those things, actually, if you want to know, it's sometimes called social media or conversation marketing. If you want to know who comes to your site, what do they say about it? You can look here, and I'm actually tempted right now, but I'll resist the temptation seeing what's happening on Viking.com, you know, what do people say about me here? And you can also go to another company site called Technorati, which actually looks at all the blogs and tries to figure out, is the sentiment positive, is the sentiment negative about you? How do people feel about you? And what's important is not the absolute number, but how does it compare now to a month ago? Maybe you changed something. Or how does it compare to your competitor? And by looking at these comparisons, all these biases basically drop out. So the web is only representative for the people who are on the web when you're there. No hope for any representativeness. So that's why you have to be smart in what statistics you're looking at, that you do like the right ratios. And then if you have enough numbers, and even for Asia 1, you know, we have hundreds of things here, you can get a feeling of what's happening, which suggests some action to you. Discovery, sites, topics, and I'm a people person. Ultimately, discovery of people. Okay, did this help a little bit, or was this too detailed? I just want to get a feeling about who thought, you know, going to live example is wasting your time. No, was good. Did you learn something? Okay, great. So then, if you have questions, I know all the sites I'm talking about. Simply ask me, and then I might decide it might be worth it, or I might decide it's just taking too long. Okay, so this was delicious here. Now I want to show you the next example, which is my photos, or actually photos about me. So here Esther Dyson, one of the internet people, took a photo saying, "There's no one quite like Andreas Weigand, former chief designer of Amazon, and secret weapon of many companies currently." So Esther, she used to run ICANN, puts this up, and of course the first person to comment is our friend Ming Yao, who probably half of you know, who says, "Haha, that's certainly the best way to describe Andreas." And not dissimilar to what Steve said at the beginning here. So here is one person who puts up public photos of people, in this case me, says who they are, and then there's a community of people immediately sort of commenting on that. Pats on the shoulder, Esther sees this picture has been viewed 7,343 times, and it is about sharing. It's about, well, it's really about lots of things. It's about data about me, and I have no way to resist this. If people want to pick up funny pictures about me, well, be my guest. What can I do about it? So it's actively contributed data, in this case pictures. And it is two community features which go towards this element of interaction, namely one of them comments, the other one tags. More on the company side. Nike, company, as you know, which makes running shoes, had an absolutely brilliant idea to take people, to get people to come to their site. Who of you has been to the Nike site? Two people. Why? Want to see what running shoes to buy, or do you know about Nike Plus? Oh, Nike Plus, okay. And you?
We were trying, actually, to duplicate what they were doing.
Okay, great. So both of you, because you have heard that this is a brilliant idea. Since the others might not be familiar with it, let me explain what happened. So Nike has a product which, you know, you can put in your shoe. It's like a GPS. And then you hook it up with your iPod, which you use when you're running. And then you can upload this to the web. A lot of work, a lot of money for nothing, most of you would think. Interesting thing is, however, that you suddenly create comparisons. Again, it's not a representative part of the world, but you create comparisons. Whoa, that dude is running on the same track as I am, and you can check him out. So you have interaction, you compare yourself, and people on average go to the site two or three times a week. So not necessarily that Nike will sell more shoes that way, but what's happening is the effect it has on marketing. So when we talk about Web 2.0, and when we talk about marketing, when we talk about Asia 1 being able to figure out what people think about it, the point is that it is not just about marketing. It is really about the way how you do your business. It's very deep. So don't just think it's some surface thing which you can ask some intern to deal with. This is company strategy. This is very much at the heart of what you do. And here are two quotes. One of them, it's a very different way to connect with consumers, says Trevor Edwards, Nike's corporate vice president for global brand and category management. People are coming to an average three times a week, so we are not having to go to them. That's the interesting thing, that people spend lots of money in customer acquisition. OCBC probably spends, $50 in customer acquisition. You got me for free, but for most other people. Whereas here, people are coming already. Same thing, by the way, for customer service. Customer service is actually the new marketing, because you already have people coming to your site who have some kind of a problem. So don't outsource this to India, where you have some Shaoji sitting in front of a computer trying to figure out, gee, what script am I going to tell the guy? But embrace the opportunity of actually learning from your customers. The second quote from here is, we're not in the business of keeping the media companies alive. Sorry, SPH. But he says, you know, we're in the business of connecting with consumers. So this is Nike, which is a global brand, a significant company. I want to run through a few examples and give a historic perspective on data. In the 70s, we had experts, I don't know, 10 million people, who learned a language the computer understands. And most of it digitizing the back office. The 80s, we had maybe 100 million people of the front office now interacting with the back office. So if you think you're checking in at SQ, and there is some person who remembers this complicated keystroke sequence, and there it is, 14A for you. In the 90s, something interesting happened, namely about 1 billion people were poking at stuff, but still pretty much sort of one-way communication. Now, this Web 2.0 stuff is happening here. That this decade, we have not only 1 billion people poking at stuff that hasn't changed, but we have 100 million people actually producing stuff. And that's the cool thing. That's the cool thing. And all these companies, these examples I gave you, are people producing stuff. Ultimately, companies are greatly leveraging. And the examples I gave you with Best Buy or Nike are real physical companies, which actually didn't have much of a web presence a few years ago. So a few examples to scare you a little bit. But I know you're Singaporean, so you're probably not that easily scared. So here's an example of a company in the Bay Area called IMMI, Integrated Media Measurement Incorporated. So if you're willing to carry a little phone with you, which every half minute makes a phone call, I mean, you don't have to worry about it, you just put it in your pocket and you're done, then, you know, we'll pay you a little bit of money. What it does, the phone, is it listens for 10 seconds and then thinks hard what's happening, and then it uploads the information of what's happening to some server somewhere, and 24/7. So let's take it as an example. This morning, 7:31, Andreas' alarm rings. 7:32, Andreas in the shower. 7:33 in the shower. 7:34 in the shower. 7:51 in the shower, clearly a candidate for separate shampoo and conditioner. Sean, on the other hand, 7:51 in the shower, 7:52 out of the shower, you know, the one gel which does everything from hair to toe. You learn a lot about people behavior, plus, of course, geolocation, how they move. This one is my hard disk. A company called Illumio scans my hard disk, everything I have in my hard disk. And I know most of you probably have some stuff on your hard disk you would not be comfortable your friends to see. And then, why on earth does it do that? It will then allow me to have a better relevance function for social questions, for question answering. For instance, here, I got, when I tried it out, the first question was some guy saying, I'm researching sentient law and want to know how does SIP work? Statistically improbable phrases, which is one of the things which I did at Amazon to figure out which words out of a book should we show to people to characterize the book. And that was really amazing. I was actually shocked that the first question I get is somebody who, one, is at Stanford, and two, wants to ask me about something which is precisely something I know quite a bit about, as opposed to Yahoo Answers, which is more of a social game. You know, hey, yeah. I was pretty disappointed when I looked at Yahoo Answers, that it's not really about creating knowledge. It's much more about, you know, poking each other.
So how did this work? This thing scans your hard disk.
Yes.
And then what happened? What happened between that and this message coming to you?
So I would not be comfortable to have actually my hard disk information go anywhere else. You know, I have a house in China. I sometimes buy software which might not be all that you know, happy for, you know what I mean. So it is not going out, but what's happening is it creates an index, actually uses my case, the Microsoft indexer, and it constantly receives, when I'm online, questions people are asking. And then it compares the question it's asking to my index. And if there's an awesome match, as it must have been here, it then pops up that question. Here, John Anderson doesn't know what's on my hard disk. Illumio doesn't know what's on my hard disk. But I know what's on my hard disk, and I know that there would potentially be a match between what the person wants to know and what I know. And then I can make the decision based on his picture. His picture's kind of generic, or whatever else, you know, his school or what he's doing, and say, hey, you know, I can help you out.
So, but where did John Anderson post his question?
He posts his question to the community at Illumio. He just types a question, sends it off to Illumio. Illumio parses it out, finds important words, sends it to so and so many Illumio users, waits for a little while, sends it to more. And then at some stage, it knows Illumio when I answer the question to him. So that goes through him. And he says, I want to have 5 answers, or I have to want 10 answers, and stuff like that. Interesting way of making money. Because the next question I got was somebody asking, hey, does anybody know headhunters in the New York finance area? And I happen to have been teaching at NYU, and I did a conference called Computer Finance, so I actually have a very good list. I said, yeah, and how much is it worth it for you? And then you can start negotiating. So the point I'm making here is that there's data on my hard drive, which is a pretty good representation of some of the stuff I'm interested in. And by sharing those data, or by making them available to actually some system which is done quite well, I now have a better life by getting only questions from people who I actually might be interested in answering. My camera and my microphone. I couldn't believe it. Then I prepared the talk. It said here, allow S3, Amazon Web Services.com storage, to access my camera and my microphone. As I am sitting in the hotel room, I get this question. What do I think? Of course, yes. Makes sense, because that way I can see those ads which actually fit to my situation of sitting in a hotel room, just by myself, as opposed to maybe watching a video on the airplane or maybe whatever else other might be doing. So that's interesting that here the computer asks you, hey, can I check you out here? Are you wearing anything, for instance, right now? Are you in a talk? You know, this is a different situation, standing in front of a class. My information, my private data, my secret phone number, or maybe Steve Miller's mobile number, how can you get it? Well, check out the site called Jigsaw. Jigsaw has 200,000 people who upload their Outlook, their basically business cards. And now you have lots of information about people, 7 million executives already a year ago. And chances are, if you want to have the CEO of Singapore Airlines mobile number, it is there. So, bah, people built walls around them. To prevent people from calling them. And now, damn, you know, his phone rings because he wanted to complain about that seat in front of the toilet or whatever. So do you get the feeling about how actually, you know, this web tool is changing how people think about information, people think about their data? And here's the next example, my DNA. This, ladies and gentlemen, is my DNA analysis. So for 400 euros, you can spit into a tube. I mean, you can spit into a tube for free, but you can spit into a tube and have your DNA analysis, and there they come out. And, you know, it's quite interesting. And that's one of the few things I didn't actually want to look at in public. Normally, I do these things in class without, you know, any worries, but here I wasn't sure. What if it tells me that I'm alcohol dependent? No worries, by the way. It was actually better than I thought, the whole thing. But that is kind of personal, you know, my DNA. Where are the updates?
Last update on the right side. You know.
Okay, this is the update of the research materials. For instance, the alcohol flush reaction was actually a survey they did. It's not just me business, 23andMe, but it's also we business. Because now they have the DNA sequence for tens of thousands of people who all paid for them themselves. And now we get a bunch of surveys. So they ask us, for instance, hey, how many glasses of wine do you need until your nose turns red? And so that would be an update, high confidence, because of course this is more than any clinical study can do if you want to understand how long does it take for your nose to turn red. The update just means that the results become more significant.
Although you don't know about the quality of the information. You know, in some of these clinical studies, if somebody ticks off something happens, chances are it did. Here, you might say the data quality is a little loose, but you have vast numbers.
Yes. So the data quality of the DNA sequence is, you know, state of the art. So there is no issue. Now, you again have the bias of people participating, but that you have in clinical studies too. That if I say I'm volunteering to drink now for the next week every day 3 glasses of wine in the evening and I see whether my wine turns. No. So, here as an example, if we look at surveys, Esther Dyson, for instance, she invited me to share, the same one who took the picture beforehand. Nothing funny going on there, by the way. So genome sharing, contacting, my surveys. So here right now there are 11 surveys I could take on pigmentation and the alcohol flash reaction I just mentioned, bitter taste, earwax, muscle performance, 10 things about me. The specifics are not important. What, ladies and gentlemen, is important is the way how companies now learn about the world. That it was just before we had the ability to easily have bidirectional communication, just not possible to find out those things and to create value, not only for the company, but also for me, that I now can see, based on my DNA analysis and based on what other people are saying, that, for instance, I have no increased risk of heart attack by drinking lots of caffeine. Some drugs work differently on 5% of the people compared to the rest of the population. For in German, there's a drug called Baldrian. Actually, I don't know what that is in English, which you give children if you want to sedate them a little bit. And it turns out 95% of children, actually it works. 5% of the children totally get hyper after that. So, I mean, I don't know whether you want to be in that seat in front of that child on that airplane, which is part of the 5% and gets Baldrian for the first time. But if you can look personalized medicine based on their data, how it would work would be different. So these are deep things about the data people are contributing, and nobody is forcing me to do this, about themselves. Big implications. I'm not sharing my DNA on the web. I'm sharing almost everything else on the web, but not my DNA, because I am worried that, who knows, in 20 years from now, there might be some smart ass health insurance who says, oh, with your risk for XYZ, sorry, yeah, that's twice the rate as for other people. And it already happens on what people are sharing on MySpace and Facebook. There was a case of a girl who was anorexic, and anorexia is an eating disorder that she didn't want to eat much because she wanted to be super slim or something like this. And I just looked it up here on the web yesterday, called The Big Data Dump. It's from The Economist, August this year. And just to cut it short is that the health insurance didn't want to pay, and then that health insurance immediately asked to see practically everything the teenager had said on the Facebook, MySpace profiles, IM threads, text messages, email messages, blog posts, and so forth. There's this information asymmetry that the health insurance wouldn't say, oh, I've read your emails, I think you should be ready for an extra massage, which we are sure of giving you, because we think it would improve your overall health. But it would only be in the case of negative impact. So we live in an interesting world where here lawsuits are fought on based on what people said at their MySpace profiles just a couple of months ago. So I would actually be somewhat slow in sharing my DNA information. I have three more examples here before going into the break. Here is an example of an insurance called Pay As You Go, which has a GPS in your car, and then you only pay when you drive. And in some way, it seems fair that if my car right now is in San Francisco, I've been on this trip for 6 weeks, I'll be back on the Saturday, and why should I pay health insurance, or car insurance rather, for the time when my car's in the garage? But then think about it. So what they compute is, it's 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and you drive from here to there, and they say, okay, that would be $2. If it's 3 o'clock at night, given on simple other statistics, there might be more accidents or less accidents, I don't know, you pay more or you pay less. Sounds fair. But I am not sure if, of course, nobody in Singapore ever would do that, but some people in America sometimes speed because the speed limit is very low. And then the GPS says, sorry, before you had that accident, you were driving 68 miles an hour, 100 kilometers an hour. We're, of course, not paying you because you were just breaking the law as you were driving. That sounds like not a good value proposition for the user. And indeed, people didn't like it. The company stopped the program 2 months ago because people didn't trust insurance. It's actually less than 10% of Americans trust the insurance. In United Arab Emirates, actually, you have to have a GPS in the car. And then when you speed, it automatically detects right away money from a bank account. So that clearly changes behavior. But people vote with their feet. And insurance is actually a tricky thing. That's why I give you DNA as an example as well. This one is, to what degree do you have a solidarity risk? And if you can change behavior to the better, I'm all for it. But you know, I can't change my DNA, even if they updates. I can't change my DNA. And so in that case, that's what I'm worried about. I have no problem putting my driving behavior. You can clearly compute from my GPS coordinates when I'm driving on 101 how fast I'm driving. Last example is my friend Go, and how Facebook tries actually to constantly, you know, get information about you. So his birthday, then it says, hey, do you want to write something on the wall? So encouraging me to do something. Then what do we have here? Down here we have traditional ads. Let me tell you a little bit about the mindset of people. I ran a couple of focus groups at Stanford last quarter in my class for clients in my class. And it turned out that people, when they're on Facebook, are just not in the mood of buying stuff. Because it's a social thing. You know, you hang out with your friends, you write in the walls, and so on. So the click-through rate is 0.1%. And the once they click purchase rate is much worse than anywhere else. So one of the things which they added is they said, well, let's add here thumbs up, thumbs down. So you can actually vote on the ads you see. And when I looked at the log there, it turns out that 10% of the ads are people who clearly state what gender they are interested in. But if you're gay, you see an ad for beautiful women over 30. Might not be all that interested in that. So Facebook is not doing a good job at all in targeting. I just don't understand why. So, but you can give feedback. And what people said before about giving feedback, the ideas are there, the execution is not there. The point I'm making here is people reveal lots of information about themselves and also about others. Last slide here on those data sources is a company called Skydeck. And what Skydeck does, it analyzes my phone records. So once again, it takes implicit information and makes it explicit. So how it works is that I allow Skydeck to access my website at my carrier, if you T-Mobile. So I give them my phone number and I give them my password. And ultimately, you know, what can they do? They can look at my bill. That's about all you can do at the website. So no big deal. Turned out, by the way, that they first thought it would be a big deal and they didn't have that option, but you had to run something on your PC. But it turned out that people came to them and said, you know, don't want to run something on my PC. Can you just please take my password and just do it in the background? Very interesting how people think about the privacy. So then here, whatever, September 22nd, Skydeck tells me who were your 10 conversations last week? And there was Go, and there was Ted Shelton, who runs the conversation group. Then they, of course, say, who is doing worse than before? Who is doing better than before? Huh, that's interesting, you know? I mean, I don't need to tell you who these people are, but it made a lot of sense. And then you have the viral marketing component. Like here, you have called Tom G in the past 2 weeks. Invite Tom to join Skydeck. So Tom is a VC at BV Capital, a company I work with. And probably I'm not the only one who is using Skydeck, early adopter. And they know that a bunch of those people actually make phone calls to Tom. So they know Tom, out of the 4,000 people in my Outlook, is a good target for me to talk to. Viral marketing. It's not that Skydeck calls up Tom and say, hey, Tom, I think you know Andreas is your friend, and we're thinking about whether you want to join Skydeck. Not that way. But they ask me, why don't you invite Tom to actually be part of Skydeck? Based on the implicit information they have.
Now, how does Skydeck, you've got your phone in your pocket, how does Skydeck know what calls you make?
Okay.
Your phone service?
No. Skydeck is a company consisting of 2.5 people in a garage, essentially, in Redwood City. And super great execution. They wrote a script which goes onto, in this case, T-Mobile website.
Who is your provider?
Who happens to be my provider? One of my 17 providers, yes. And then grabs my calling history.
You have to give them access? Or?
Yes. So I give them my phone number, and I give them my password. And what happens is they then go grab my calling patterns. And now when I'm abroad, actually, I don't use my US phone very much. So you'll probably not get a particularly exciting thing because the roaming costs are just too high. Particularly after Yinghan found me a local card where I can call the US for 15 cents a minute. So don't expect too much right now because I haven't been using it much in the last couple of weeks. Now they are loading. They are going to the website every day, screen scrape or use web services or whatever is the right way. And they are coming up with analysis of my calling data. By the way, how do they make money? How would they make money?
But this requires that your mobile provider provide an online list of what your calls are.
Oh, yeah, but I think every, it's just basically my electronic bill, which they're having. I'm giving them access to, and I have actually not made any calls here recently, apparently. Let's not waste time on this right now. They have access in some way. It's a strange website. If I mouse over it, it goes away. I'll get it working in the break. The point is that they get access to information, implicit information from me. I give them additional information, namely who are the people's names, and now they give value back to me. And they give value back to me and reminding me who I should be calling. But also, they give monetary value back to me by saying, with your calling patterns, you would actually save money instead of using T-Mobile if you were going to using AT&T. Plus, of course, they know my friends, they know my social network much more than Facebook, for instance, does. They know my real, actual behavior. Who do I hang out with? Who do I talk to? Okay, so let's take a moment and see what and review what we have learned here in our first hour. And for that, I'll look at my own notes here. In the first hour, we talked about how important it is for companies to think about their data strategy. How do we get actually people to give us data so we can serve them better? How can we allow users to create value? So don't treat them as your enemy. Try to provide a platform for them so they can actually help themselves, and by helping themselves, they can help you. Why is data important? Data helps us making better decisions. Basically, with possible exception of religion, all decisions, or business decisions at least, ought to be based on data. Who will make money in this game? Well, those who reduce the information asymmetry. Those who genuinely help people make better decisions. The Amazon example showed that even if you show people other websites they could be going to, if people feel supported in the decision making as opposed to feel screwed or taken hostage, people will come back. Why is this all happening now? Because communication, the cost of communication, has dramatically dropped. It used to be that the main cost of communication, for instance, in a company interacting with a customer, was borne by the company sending out something, maybe a dollar to send out a marketing material. That cost has dropped a fraction of a cent electronically. So that means the previously prominent primary cost has now become the secondary cost, and the cost of the recipient is the main cost. Cost of the recipient, and not the money, but his attention, his time. So now, by companies doing attention rape of, you know, grabbing the attention of people, do not do themselves a favor, because they don't measure people who they piss off. But overall, their reputation does very poorly. For instance, Fingo is a company I never knew I had signed up. I still get messages by Fingo, and I don't know how to stop it. Would I ever have a positive experience, Fingo or something, some phone thing? Would I ever have a positive experience, anything positive to say about it? Of course not. So the social aspects actually are super important, what's happening. And measuring those, even if it's not sales down the road, but much more upstream, trying to understand what people's reaction is on stuff we give them and making it trivially easy for them to tell you something whenever they want to tell you something. That, I think, is the message I want to get across in the first half here, the first hour. I deliberately chose a bunch of examples because I think you are from such a different, broad variety of backgrounds that rather than teaching, you know, some framework, showing these examples, some of them quite controversial. I'm fully aware of that. I'm not saying that this is the way the world ought to be, but I'm just saying these are examples, real-world examples you can all use. I hope that something is happening in your minds. We are now go to our little coffee break or tea break. We then do the group work. In the group work, we'll think about how the four P's of marketing have changed based on this data-rich world, based on this communication-rich world. After that, we'll watch the quick movie, and then I will talk about some specific cases, and then we'll end with a question a Straits Times reporter who I talked to yesterday asked me to please come up with an answer, and I promised I would ask you. I know it will be a fun question for you. So on this note, 10-minute break, bathroom, coffee, cookies, or whatever there is, and we'll be back at 10:40. Okay?